I'm just upset. I don't know. I'm in a shitty mood.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about this on the podcast at all. I'm just mad. I'm like, I just am depressed about politics, and I'm depressed about all, you know, trying to read Twitter and like seeing everyone's like shitty tweets about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was spared a little bit of that because Twitter on my phone, it only lets me see like the last like 4 or 5 replies that get added at me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was going to spend the whole day in an airport anyway, which is, you know, at best mediocre, right? Like your best day ever in the airport is like your worst day ever at the zoo. you know, and so I was already kind of settled in, and so, I mean, it's awful news, but it was nice to see most of the people on my feed not just being compassionate, but like also being moderately intelligent about it. Where, you know, because in compassion is where you have to start, and with empathy and people talk and sometimes just sharing honest emotional response, which is horror and dismay and upset. And then a lot of people came in and said, how about let's not be dicks using this for an excuse? And then some other people came in and said, how about let's not like use hate as a way of making ourselves feel better? And I was impressed by that, because that's a long way down the humanity road. You know, that's level 12 humanity right there, is being confronted by something truly horrific and not wanting to just do anything to make yourself feel better, and therefore you use rage as a tonic. And so that's what I saw mostly on my feed, and I didn't talk a lot. I retweeted things that other people were saying. I don't doubt that if I were to peek into my feed right now, I'd see a lot of people making a lot of arguments that disillusion me about humanity, but luckily I've been spared that today.
Yeah, you know, the thing I think, and you know, this is not a comment about anyone in particular, you know, including yourself or anyone who talks about, who goes on, you know, who has things to say about about sad events in the world or tragedies, whatever. unless I have something to involving like people's safety or something, I just say nothing. I feel like that's usually kind of the right call. Like there are other people who are directly affected, or there's people on my side politically who are like, if they want to go have that battle, they're better equipped to handle it, you know, 5 minutes after the event breaks or whatever. But there's this great blog post I love. I don't know the guy's name, but it's this blog called Raptitude. And he wrote a post that I think about all the time called The Art of Letting Others Be Right. And he tells this great story about he saw this episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show, like way back in the day. He says, I was never exactly a fan of the Oprah Winfrey Show, but I've seen hours and hours of it. For years after it went off the air, I kept remembering a particular insight that Oprah shared once. I forget the context, but Oprah was amazed to realize that she didn't have to answer the phone just because it was ringing. It was a significant insight for me, too, not because answering the phone is a particularly difficult task, but because it meant that there was an invisible freedom there, which I somehow didn't realize that I had. Even if I still answered every call, it suddenly felt like it was a choice. Before that, it had been kind of a master-slave type relationship in which some remote person could push some buttons and force my body up onto its feet to answer the phone. And he goes on to say, for those of us inclined to argue every point, it's easy to forget that we have the freedom to simply carry on with our lives and let wrong viewpoints stand. It's amazing how often it can seem like an exchange needs your input, the way a screaming kettle needs to be taken off the element.
A screaming kettle is a great way of putting that.
But I don't know. I always find it's like, oh, it's just like, it's just, so, I'm just so sad and I feel so hopeless. Like what? I just have nothing to say. I don't know. I got nothing.
Yeah.
I thought your tweet about thought your tweet about writing a story for your kids was very sweet.
Yeah, that's. I was gonna go beyond that, you know, and then talk about why I was doing that instead of anything else. Because I honestly don't think I mean, I never retweet, you know. I just, for most things, I assume that, people sign up to my Twitter to hear me talk, and if I want to retweet something, I'll typically add commentary to it because I figure that's what people are showing up for. But all I really did today was retweet other people. And I guess it's a lot of what you were talking about is, I did not necessarily need to add my voice to this, given that other people who maybe who had more right to, or more, maybe more eloquence, or maybe a little more math, or maybe a little more ethos, were saying these things. And so I never retweet. I think that's all I did. I probably lost several hundred followers because, I was just retweeting and retweeting. And then I wrote about wanting to make up a story for my boys where there were two princes and they kissed each other and they were happy. And then I was going to go on for a little bit and say, this might seem like not very much, and it really isn't very much, and it doesn't fix anything, and it doesn't make these people not dead, and it doesn't unfuck our country, and it doesn't, it doesn't unkink people's heads who have been poisoned, through bad argument and bad information their whole lives. But then I didn't, I didn't go down that little road. It's, and I don't know why this one hit me particularly hard.
Well, it's ter I mean, it's political terrorism against a cause that we that you know that both of us feel strongly about, right? It seems pretty clear at this point that's what happened, and I don't know. It's like what can you say? It's like I'm not going to change any. It's not going to influence my political beliefs. I'm not going to support. It's not going to affect how I feel about supporting gay rights. I'm not going to live my life any different. It's just depressing.
Part of it for me, what's funny, I don't know if I've told this story on here. You're going to have to start warning me because I do have a finite number of stories, and if we talk for, an increasing number of hours, I'll start to repeat myself. But it was a couple of years ago when I was down at Phoenix Comic Con. So it was almost exactly 2 years ago. And I went down there and I was hanging out with some friends. And my little boy, my older boy, was watching TV in the other room, which was really kind of a treat for him because we don't have cable at home. So he was watching this show about science and he kept running into the room. Did I tell you about this?
No.
Yeah, he kept running into the room and he'd said, "Dad, there's these beams from space and nobody knows where they come from." And he wouldn't even wait. He was just reporting. He ran back into the other room, and then he'd come back and he goes, "Dad, did you know that black holes, they're so strong that even light can not get out. Even light, Dad." And then he would run away. Later that night, I was in bed with him, and he was still all lit up about this show, and he was telling me about quasars, and it was just fascinating to me, like how interested he was in that, and how much he was repeating this information. And I realized that he was just hungry for stuff. Like being exposed to this new information was just delicious to him. And that's what kids at this age are. They don't question. They're merely absorbing. And I'd been planning for a long time and doing little bits and pieces to sort of, broaden up his foundational knowledge of the world in a way that my knowledge wasn't. We grew up in the culture. I was exposed to fairly regular cultural stories, and therefore, for the most part, I grew up thinking that like boys and girls were in love, and that was kind of it. And then I didn't get clued in till a lot later down the road. And so, like Boys and Boys in Love, you know, it wasn't a horrifying thing because I hadn't been taught to hate it, but it didn't strike me. I was kind of surprised by it when it finally impinged on my awareness. And so I was there in bed with him, and I said, did you know that sometimes a boy and another boy can love each other and they can get married? And he said, I did not know that. And it wasn't, you know, and it was that exact, I did not know that. And I said, yes. And I go, you know, sometimes a girl and a girl can love each other and they can get married too. And that was it. And there was no, like, there was no questions. There was no, like, so, you know, who's the husband and who's the bride? There was none of that. He was just like, huh, okay. And he's like, but the thing about quasars. But when kids are little, it's like you don't need to fool them into changing their cultural perceptions.
Right. If you don't have cultural norms, you don't need to be like gently have this story broken to you about how your cultural norms are wrong.
Exactly. So he was just like, oh, okay, boys and boys. Right. But black holes.
Reminds me of this great Louis C.K. bit about gay marriage. Like one of my favorite bits of his where he's like, I can't understand people complaining about how gay marriage has any effect on their life. People try to talk about gay marriage like it's a social issue. Like you see someone stand up on a talk show and they say, how am I supposed to explain to my child that two men are getting married? And he goes, I don't know, it's your shitty kid. You fucking tell him. Why is that anyone else's problem? Two guys are in love and they can't get married because you don't want to talk to your ugly child for 5 fucking minutes?
You know, I've heard the same thing, like, where, you know, a lot of people, you know, I mean, circumcision was the norm for a long time. And this actually is like an amazingly hot topic. And I think the reason for that is whenever, I mean, anything that touches on children is like, has the opportunity to completely combust, you know, and so especially something that people do to a child or something that somebody might have done to their child with the best of intentions. And you know, not to overshare, but I don't fucking care. You know, I was circumcised. A lot of people, especially my age, it's standard. A lot of boys who are my age were just circumcised out of like matter of course in hospitals because like sometimes the parents weren't even asked. It was just assumed that a boy would be circumcised. Now there's a lot of more modern, you know, stuff where people are saying, you know, maybe the best way to introduce somebody to the world is not by cutting off part of his dick. You know, like maybe this might do weird things to a kid's head. Like they get born, they see light, and then suddenly you snip off part of their dick. That might kind of skew them towards a certain expectation of the world. You know, and I joke, but it's something that I had to confront when I was getting ready to have kids my own. I'm like, if they're boys, what will I do? And one of the things that comes there is just what you mentioned. It's like, well, if you are circumcised and your kids aren't, you know, what'll they do? How will they deal with that when they see that their penis looks different from yours?
So all this is the prime child penis content that gets edited right out of this podcast every week.
But the thing is, like, I'm totally comfortable sharing this story.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. I'll let you make the call. You make the final editorial call on this anyway.
Okay.
I don't feel bad sharing it, you know, because I share so many stories about my little boy. But I think this one is instructive, you know, where I'm in the bathroom, and you can leave this story in, too, because it makes me look really good, right? As a parent, as a man.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the bathroom, and of course, like, your kids will see you pee, because if nothing else, you're trying to show them that, like, peeing in the potty is awesome, so you can stop them just pissing everywhere else.
God, being a parent is so bizarre.
You know, I'm in the bathroom, and I'm peeing, and, you know, he comes in, because he'll pee with me, right? Because that's, you know, you do that when you have kids. And this was a long time ago. This was probably more than 2 years. And he goes, Dad, he goes, your penis is really big. And he goes, my penis is pretty small. He goes, because you are big. And so you have a big penis. And I am just a small child. And so I have a small penis. And I'm like, yep, pretty much. And that was it. And it wasn't like, boy, I've noticed that I'm circumcised and you're not, or our penises. Like, he figured that out himself. He's like, you're big. You look a certain way. I'm little. I look this way. And it's like, it was just like, boy, the sun is out. You know, it's like no commentary, no worry, no anxiety, no nothing. You know, and plus, it's always nice, you know, for somebody to tell you that your penis looks big, even if it's your kid. You know, that's a compliment.
Well, no connection of any kind to that discussion, but we did get some very nice listener feedback this week. Our listener Joshua wrote in to say, he says he wanted to comment on some of the statements that I made when we were talking about writing the Torah from 2 weeks ago.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's a fine transition. And this was stuff that I either never knew or I knew it and I blocked it out like everything else I learned in my horrible Sunday school. Okay, number one, Joshua, this is all from Joshua. He says, number one, the penalty for dropping a copy of the Bible, meaning like a book or something, is indeed to kiss it. Not mentioned is that the official penalty for actually dropping one of the Torah scrolls is to fast for 40 days. I totally forgot that. And I totally knew that, and I was very scared of that as a kid, because some, you know, you take turns, and sometimes you carry the Torah, and you're like, I do not want to drop this thing and fast for 40 days. And he says, not only that, but anyone who witnesses the event must also fast for the full 40 days. As you can imagine, this is not usually done, even in the rare case where the scroll actually falls. I have actually experienced such an occurrence, and the rabbi ruled that the congregation should split up the 40 days among them, with a donation to charity as an acceptable alternative. In his words... The rabbi's words, he said, dropping a Torah is bad, but never as bad as dropping a baby. And that's awesome. That's exactly the kind of smart rules lawyering that I am into with Judaism. That's what
absolutely.
I love.
Absolutely. And, you know, you see that, I feel like you see that more in Judaism than you do in Christianity.
Oh, big time. Judaism is, there's a whole holiday where you negotiate with God to write you into the book of life.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you make a deal.
I'm going to shame myself that I don't know what that one's called.
It's Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah. It's one of the big boys. I don't know. I can't remember which one. Rosh Hashanah is the happy one where you eat the apples. I think Yom Kippur is the sad one where you have to ask God not to kill you that year. Joshua goes on. He says, number two, there is no tradition to burn scrolls that were written with a mistake. While a Torah that is missing a single letter is not, quote-unquote, kosher, meaning not valid for reading, you can simply correct things by either adding or scratching out some ink. In an extreme case, you can replace part of the scroll that is damaged or wrong. And there is a slightly stricter rule for mezuzahs and tefillin. Mezuzahs are the little boxes with the little scroll in it that goes by the door. And tefillin they're sort of like it's like a little box, a little wooden box with a scroll in it, and you wrap it around your head like a Jewish do-rag. And you need to write things in order, so fixing an error means erasing everything after the mistake and rewriting. But those are much shorter, only four paragraphs. And I always love that stuff, the mezuzahs and the tefillin. I have my grandpa's tefillin somewhere. Hopefully I still have that. But those things are cool because I always thought like that was some like good like old-fashioned wizard shit. Like, you put a spell in a little box on your head and See, this is the part where it's like I could tell you that you do it when you're in a minyan and that it's like you do it on high holidays and all that. But like I don't exactly remember why you wrap tefillin. I think it supercharges your prayers.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's like prayer nitro. It's like prayer plus. It's an IAP. This is how it works, Pat. It's an IAP. You pay 20 cents, and it boosts your prayer straight to God. I think that's how it works. It's like a little antenna.
So you're saying that God accepts micropayments is what you're saying?
Oh, big time. God's broke, according to every major religion. And then let's see. There was one more. There was a couple good. One more thing he says. In any case, the burning thing is a big no-no. But Torah scrolls that are beyond repair are carefully buried in specially assigned burial plots. And I think I've actually seen that. I think I've seen that in Jewish cemeteries.
You know, I think I remember hearing about that too, where, and it created an interesting kind of resonance. I don't know. I know I've asked you this before. You are not a big Discworld reader. You haven't read Pratchett?
Boy, I read a lot of Terry Pratchett in sixth and seventh grade, and unfortunately, I haven't gone back. It's one of those things of like, I think I'd get a lot more out of it now that I'm a little older, and I should probably go back and reread some of that.
Yeah, his earlier stuff was good to great, and his later stuff was like it's among the best writing I've ever read. But the dwarves, you know, eventually you learn, you know, a little bit more about their culture, and some of that was, you know, that writing was sacred. You never erase it. You never get rid of it. And when I remember reading that about the dwarves, I go, oh, this is interesting. It feels like a little bit of a, you know, influenced by this piece of, you know, the sacredness of text.
And also, much like the Jews, they live in the center of the earth and are obsessed with gold. And then Joshua's final comment is, he says, while the Talmud is pretty reasonably described as the director's cut, which is kind of what I called it, the Haftorah, the one reads at the Bar Mitzvah, generally comes from the prophet section of the Bible. Which actually, I guess I did know that. Taking your bar mitzvah as an example, since the Torah portion was from the end of Shemot, one would assume that the Haftorah portion of the reading was from the book of Isaiah 27:6, which he fucking nailed from my very brief description of it. And then he says, also, these things are pretty stable. So assuming you were born in 1988, one could assume that your birthday was in the week ending on January 29th. And he was so close. I was born in 1987, and my birthday was 10 days earlier than that. But good on Joshua for piecing that together. That I was crazy impressed by that.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah. Anyhow, so that was all my my Judaism follow up, and we also got some good science follow up on Twitter. As a reminder, Pat and I are very interested in surprising, fascinating science facts, and we don't really care if they're true or not. We just want some. Just give us some good shit.
Yeah, I spotted one. I think my favorite that I spotted on Twitter was somebody saying that possums had 13 nipples that formed a circle with 12 in a circle and the 13th in the middle. I want it to be true, even though I don't really believe it. That's a pretty good science fact.
That's a great science fact. Wow. That's true. Of course that's true. We saw it on Twitter. Can I give you a discussion question? Discussion question for the evening. So I as you know, I do this zine. The zine is, for me, it's sort of a project that is about denying myself the feeling that posting on social media is the same as doing my work during the day. And I often feel like, well, if I post a bunch of funny, good stuff on Twitter, on my blog, on Tumblr, or whatever, that it's like, oh, well, I've accomplished something today. And that can be pretty detrimental because, A, it gives me a false feeling of accomplishment that actually affects my amount of actual work that I get done. So that's pretty bad. But also, B, like, I find that no matter how much time I dump into Twitter and Tumblr and all of that, I never have anything to show for it. Like, at the end of the year, it's like I can't really go back and be like, look at all of the work that I accomplished by putting hours and hours of my time into this. So the zine was this idea of, like, collecting the stuff that I love. You know, the kinds of things I read in the podcast of, like, these, like, little interesting quotes from articles and little pieces of fiction and quotes from articles. And you know, just these little bits and pieces, and sort of assembling them into these thematic zines. And I did a little Kickstarter for this, and people subscribed, and I just mail this thing out every once in a while. I'll put the link on my website if anyone is interested for any reason in the zine. But one of the things I do that my editor Carly has kind of pushed me into doing is I write a little introduction to every zine that sort of sets up the topic and what I think about it. And this month or this last couple months, I've been working on a zine about technology. And, you know, it's not like a bunch of news articles about technology. Like, I'm interested in, you know, like what we talk about on the podcast, like philosophy of technology, philosophy of science, like big existential questions of, like, you know, what are people doing with technology? What does it mean for us? And I've been trying to write a little one-page introduction to this tech zine for 4 months unsuccessfully.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just like brutal writer's block of the topic is so broad and I am so reluctant to say anything about it that I'm just stuck in the mud. So I had a conversation the other day sort of pertaining to this that reminded me of this. With my friend Nathan Allen, who's the artistic director of the House Theater here in Chicago, which is a wonderful theater that I'm absolutely in love with. They do, like, the best, most interesting, forward-thinking theater in Chicago, in my opinion. And Nate was telling me that he's also a teacher at University of Chicago, he teaches theater. And when he teaches his students, he often asks them, what is theater for? Which I thought was a really interesting question. And I don't love, like, I don't know. I'm not a big theater guy. Like, I don't have a ton of thoughts about theater. And I was surprised that as we started talking about this, that idea of, like, what theater is for, I was surprised that I had an opinion on it. And I was sort of starting to think about why theater exists and its relationship of, like, you know, all of these things that we talk about of, like, you know, living in a world filled with technology, like, what does theater do for you? And I thought, this is something Pat probably has some feelings about.
What theater is for?
Yeah, what's theater for?
Theater, like, live stage theater as opposed to visual storytelling?
Yeah, that's a good distinction. So I think what we mean is, like, a live performance that you see where there's actors and you're in physical space.
Yeah. See, actually, this touches on something I was kind of hoping to bounce off of you because, like, the Tony Awards were tonight and Hamilton, I mean, spoiler alert, right? Hamilton won everything. And, you know, I'm actually not a big one for theater either. I mean, I love plays, but I read plays, you know, or I don't necessarily go and see plays. I'll enjoy theater, but I don't pursue it as much as I feel like I kind of should. So I'm taking my typical circuitous route towards maybe taking a stab at this question. But one of my things is it turns out, like, Lin-Manuel is a fan of my books, and, you know, I'm kind of a fan of, like, just a bunch of the stuff that he does as well, to say nothing of the fact that, like, he's got style. You know, he's got style in spades. He's got this swagger. I had a weird, pipe dream a little bit. Like, I'm like, oh, if he were a little bit younger, I'd want him to play Kvothe in the movie. But then, actually, I was thinking, I'm like, no, not Kvothe. He could be Kvothe's dad. I think he would be an amazing Arlabin, right? Like, he just got music all the way through him, and he's beautiful, and he's proud, and he's good. And, like, to be able to bring in, like, a legitimate, you know, somebody ethnic to play one of the Rue, you know, it would help resolve one of my lingering fears about Hollywood, you know, kind of doing its typical all white people thing in my movie. And I just feel like he could bring a lot to that. That,
you know, you don't see him as a little, maybe a little Elodin.
Oh, sure. I mean, oh my God, I hadn't thought of that. Oh, he would be, but, oh man. And see, I have been drinking this elephant booze and now I forget what I was talking about. I haven't seen Hamilton, you know, I mean, very few people have actually gone to see the play. It's out in New York. You know, you can't buy tickets in any conventional sense, but tickets are all, you know, everything is for sale if you are willing to pay enough money. And it's been preying on my mind more and more that, you know, I mean, he's going to stop playing Hamilton.
Yeah, I have that. I'll be honest. I hope Lin-Manuel Miranda does not ever listen to this podcast. But so here's the thing. I obviously have not seen Hamilton. I don't live in New York. I don't have any connection to it. I have no way to go. I haven't gotten into it. And nothing could be more overhyped right now. Like, I just, it can't, it just, I, the cynical, arch sort of commentator part of my brain is like going like, nothing is this good. It's impossible.
Right. And it's, I mean, you can cop to it. You know, I've got it too. We're curmudgeons.
Yeah.
You know, it's harder for you to accept it because you're younger than I am. But once you hit 40, curmudgeon fits really easy. And like, although honestly, the other one that it used to be with me was Buffy. Like, everyone told me how much they loved Buffy. And I said, you know, I'll be goddamn before I watch your stupid vampire cheerleader show. And of course, now I'm like a born again, you know, Whedonista, where I'm a missionary for his work. But do you feel that same thing where, like, to go and experience this thing in like a moment in time is, you know, I feel like that is part of what theater is for. It's not just the play. It's the event. It's the iteration. It's the fact that it's a moment in time.
Oh, that's very interesting. I certainly feel that that's true about Hamilton. And I think, is it going to be much worse without the original cast versus with it? Absolutely not. But seeing Hamilton in 2016 is a cultural event the likes of which there have not been that many in my lifetime. And it's like, you know, it's like asking your folks, like, did you go to Woodstock, right? It's like, this is a thing that in 50 years people are going to ask, where were you when Hamilton was playing in New York with Lin-Manuel Miranda? It's a cultural moment.
Should we go together? I would feel better.
I'd get on a plane in a minute and go do that with you. That'd be very fun.
Okay.
God, people would be so mad at me. Listen, but in all seriousness, I'm happy to go. But don't take, I am the least excited person on Hamilton in the continental United States.
Well, no, but like it would make me feel better, right? If like you wanted to go too, it makes me feel like I'm not maybe like, I don't know, like trend chasing, you know?
No, we are. Whatever. Who cares?
You know, it, boy, yeah, you're right. We got to cop to it.
Who cares? But it's like, you know, it's like, is that going to stop you from doing this awesome thing?
You know, the only reason it would is because of pride, right? And I got to get on top of my pride.
I don't know. You can go 50 layers of Inception deep of like, well, is it my ego that's making me want to be there, or is it my ego wanting to not look like I want to be seen going to it? You can go 1,000 layers deep into that dream, but it's just like at the end of the day, it's like I want to see Hamilton in 2016 with the cast. Like, are you kidding? Like, that is the literal definition of a once in a lifetime memory. So yeah, and you got to do it.
That's what I keep thinking is like this is actually one of those rare once in a lifetime things. And I'm pretty sure, you know, like if I take a lady to Hamilton, like I'm pretty much, you're guaranteed to get a little bit of play afterwards, aren't you?
Now that's a bad reason to go.
No, that's the best reason. That's biologically viable reason to go see Hamilton.
Oh man, between this and the child penis, this episode is going to get, we're going to have 3 minutes of footage and it's literally going to be like, oh, hey Pat, how are you? Pretty good. Here's some news about the Torah and we're done.
So what was your thought about the reasoning of theater?
So here's where I'm going with the theater thing, and I'm curious. I'm specifically be interested. I haven't sort of talked about this idea or this argument really with anyone. So I'm curious if you can sort of poke any holes in it, or if it sort of crumbles when I try to like say it. So one of the things, like when Nate asks his students what theater is for, He said they always come back and they say things like, oh, theater's for empathy building, theater is for making a community, theater is to help people see and understand each other. He lumped that into a category that he called, quote, Aristotelian shit. So that's all the high and mighty stuff that theater is for. I have a slightly different, I have a more like operative idea of like what theater is for, which is theater is to entertain people. It's to distract you from your own pending mortality for 5 minutes so you can like enjoy your life. But that's not to say that there is nothing special about theater as an entertainment medium. And like theater people would do well to remember that. I think theater is entertainment. And like any kind of old fashioned thing that's been around since, you know, ancient Greece, like we've reinvented it a million times. And now there are other kinds of entertainment that really serve almost the same function as theater, and they have a much lower threshold to enjoy them. So it's like you can go to a movie, you could watch a movie on Netflix without leaving your house, and the movie is perfectly paced and it has the most beautiful actors and it's shot in the most engaging way. Like it titillates every one of your senses in a perfectly like clinically tested way, right? So it's very, very, very difficult for theater to compete with that. And I think one of the scary trends about theater, or the trends that I don't like anyway about theater, is theater has attempted to remain relevant by becoming more movie-like, meaning it's faster and it's more done like a movie with like crazy effects and stunt casting and things like that. But it's such a stupid fight for theater to pick, because if theater is trying to fight a war over what medium of art can be most like a movie, movies are going to win that war. Like, that's a horrible war to fight. But there are some things that theater can do that movies can't do. And like when I think about what The House does, which is the theater, you know, Nate's theater that I really like. So everything is every show they do is set in the round, meaning you can see wherever you're sitting, you can see other audience members. Their shows often break the fourth wall, so characters address the audience directly, especially like at the beginning and ends of plays. And they give you these huge moments of tension and catharsis that play on the fact that you're sitting in a chair with the actors. So they have ways of involving the audience in the as like a participant in the play that heighten. So it's not just that you're watching a good story, it's that you feel that you become part of it by being present. So the play is aware of an audience being there, if that doesn't sound too weird. And it works so well. I mean, you cry and you laugh and you're on your feet and you're stomping and you're just like part of it. And there's just a crazy energy to it. So, and I think there's like, and the more I started thinking about this, like, I think, and this is what got me thinking about the technology connection, is like, I think there's an analogy to any kind of old technology. Of the same thing is true of newspapers, right? What are newspapers for? Like, now it's like I can go on BuzzFeed and read a bunch of listicles, and that is way more entertaining and gripping, and it's a quick little hit of dopamine, and it's so much better than what a newspaper can do, right? They're showing me big pictures, and they're showing me videos, and it's all in my face and it's moving really quickly. And like newspapers can't do that, but newspapers are moving in that direction of like they have a lot of like statistics and full page photography, and that newspapers are trying to become more and more like a website. But like, again, if you're a newspaper, why would you fight the war of what medium can be most like a website if you're not websites? Like, it's right. It's just crazy. But there's a thing that websites can't really do, which is have a team of dedicated reporters that explain things with nuance and context that newspapers can do. And I wish that newspapers were smart enough to zero in on that in the same way that good theater zeroes in on the things that only theater can do. And I think what's a bummer about that for people who work in those mediums is you're acknowledging, like, if you're a newspaper and you're like, okay, we're just going to do the special things that newspapers do. And if you're a theater and you're like, we're just going to do the special things that theaters can do. I think there's a little bit of admitting defeat there of like you're saying, well, we're not going to be the thing anymore, right? Like, we're not going to be the number one main form of entertainment in the world, the same as it was in ancient Greece. But that's okay, because the people who are still passionate about theater, they'll still have a niche and they'll still meet they will create the thing that the audience that wants to see theater most wants to see, which is the most theater-like theater.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and this is like super... This is actually part of what's been preying on my mind today. is, you know, I was in LA to talk about movie stuff. And it feels like I'm always in LA talking about movie stuff. And, you know, one of the thoughts, you know, it's like if you look at, you think of, you know, if you're an author, right, and also a Pokemon, you have a series. Did you like that?
Yeah, I did like that, yeah.
You have a series of evolutions that you're going to go through to reach your final form. And, like, what's the theoretical, like, end? Like, you know, what helps your power level reach 9,000 as an author? Well, you get a movie made out of your book, right? And that's sort of, like, it's sort of every author's dream. Or at least culturally, it's sort of, it's like an underlying cultural assumption that, like, the best thing that could happen to an author is a movie gets made out of your book. And the folk wisdom is that even if it's an awful movie, and you can probably even say it, even though you're not in traditional publishing, even if it's an awful movie, then, like, what's the benefit to the author?
Oh, you're going to sell a ton of books.
Oh, yeah. So you sell a ton of books. It gets you exposure. It gets, you know, you get the books in the hands of people who never would have read a book before. And you get to roll around in, you know, theoretically, a huge pile of money. And I will admit that when all of this conversation started, and we had our podcast back then when I was, I talked some super caffeinated crazy talk in the midst of those initial, you know, movie pitch meetings. And I was jazzed, you know, and I felt cool, and I felt like the prettiest girl at the party, and I felt desired, and to be desired by Hollywood is sort of like a special sort of desired, because, you know, what you were talking about theater and newspapers, even for a while, newspapers were media. Like, they were the king. You know, there was nothing bigger than newspaper in terms of getting your news. And then, like, then they became slowly supplanted by television news a bit. And then slowly television news has become supplanted by the internet. And so these older mediums, these older genres in some ways, you know, it's not enough that they're not the biggest anymore, but they used to be the biggest. And they're, like, almost conceptually butthurt over that. Like, you know, theater is like, you know, we used to be the biggest, we can still be the biggest, and those are the people that end up trying to be like movies. When you're right, that's a dumb fight to fight, because nothing can be more movie than a movie. You know, and when they finally figure out how to VR chip stuff directly into our brains, then movies will have this same thing where they'll be like, they'll desperately try to look like VR,
right?
You know, and fail. But, you know, I'm thinking about this movie stuff, and I was dazzled, and I was flattered, and I was excited. You know, I was, you know, and now I increasingly feel, you know, because I've got an amazing deal, and Lionsgate is an amazing group of people, and if this goes even moderately well, it'll mean an incredible amount of money and an incredible amount of exposure. But, you know, I run up against this feeling, right? And did you read The Lord of the Rings, or?
Never made it through.
Yeah, it's not that surprising. When did you first try?
I think I was too old. I think I was in high school.
Yeah, so, I mean, some people, for The Lord of the Rings, it's like when you try it, and plus, I love Tolkien, but the first 180 pages are pretty boggy. You know, God bless you, Tolkien. You made our genre, but it's a dated piece of writing. Anyway, you know, there's the Galadriel scene, right? where Sam or where Frodo says, "You can have the ring. You know, you're one of the wise. You can take it." And it's a great moment in the book, and it's a great moment in the movie. And she says, "Oh yes, you know, I would take it, and I would be beautiful and powerful, and I'd be fair as like a thunderstorm, and I would take this power, and you know, I think she says, you know, instead of a dark lord, you would have a queen, and she's like, oh, the things that I would do, and then she says, no, I pass the test. I will fade and go into the West. And she says that because she's one of the wise. That's how you know who is wise in Middle Earth, who is willing to not pursue power. And Gandalf does the same thing. You know, Gandalf wants it because he feels like he's really going to need it. He wants it in a different way, even. And he says, I will need its strength. He goes, and I am already so tired. He goes, but do not offer it to me. And I think about this movie deal, it's like, it will give me money. It will give me a social media reach. It will put me on lists. It will get me on talk shows. It will, you know, like it will do this. But here's the thing, to me it feels like cheating. Because like, and I think you can appreciate this, right? And it sounds weird to put it in these terms, but we're self-made men, you and me. You know, like I wrote this book and I didn't get where I am alone, right? But I wrote this book, I got published, got lucky, got super lucky, never deny that. But like right now I am a success because the thing I made is good, and because I made good choices and capitalized on my opportunities. And you're very much in the same way.
I see what you mean. You know, there was never a point in the time that, you know, when you were working on Name of the Wind as your first book where anyone came up to you and was like, I'm going to give you a huge advance to, like, you know, I'm just going to hand you this opportunity on a silver platter. Like, you had to go out and write this thing and do the work to start it. And the movie is a little bit different because people are coming to you and they're saying, like, we're just going to give you money and go do this thing. And if it succeeds, you're going to get the credit. And, you know, if it fails, you'll still sell a ton of books. I get that. I think where the analogy breaks down for me is, like, the movie, you know, making a film is not the ring. The ring is a magical object. This goes back to our conversation about, you know, what you can take from genre fiction into your life and where it starts to crumble. And where this starts to crumble is, like, the movie's not the ring. The ring is a magical object that gives these abilities to you 100%. And the movie's not that. The movie, it's going to incrementally give you more money that you probably, you know, I know you well enough to know you're not going to do anything with it, and you'll just still be drinking soup out of your deli tainers. You know, it's going to let you meet, I guess, whatever celebrities or whatever you want to meet. But I also know you well enough to know that I don't think you want to, like, be seen drinking at a bar with Brad Pitt. Like, I think you have your friends and you pick them because they're interesting people. And they're nice.
See, it's
myself. I mean, obviously, you're friends with me because I'm famous and important. But everyone else, I mean, no. But you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. Maybe that's where it starts to fall apart. Is it's like it's not this all powerful corrupting thing. And that's another big trap that people fall into is they think, well, if I just reach this milestone, right? Where, and you're totally right that in the world of books, like getting the movie deal is the milestone, where that's the end, right? It's like, oh well, if I just get this one thing, I'll finally have it, right? It's like I'm running. I'm finally, this is the end, and I'm going to get there. And of course, like the more you believe it, the more you're let down when you get there and it's not the end. Because it's like, and that's the thing with any, it's like that great David Foster Wallace commencement speech. He's like, everybody picks something to worship, and whatever you pick, it that's what does you in. So it's like, if you worship being beautiful, every year that you live will just be dying 1,000 deaths. And if you worship money, you'll never have enough. And if you worship being smart, you'll always feel like a fraud. It's like that's the thing that's going to do you in. And, you know, it's like to the extent that you worship like the prestige and the whatever of having a movie, it's like or the money or whatever. It's like, well, it'll never be complete. Like someone else will always have the new movie or the more successful movie. It's like if you get enough money to buy your mega yacht that I know you want, it's like suddenly you'll just be mad that, you know, Steve Ballmer parked his yacht next year's and his yacht is 20 feet longer.
Well, but how about this? Because it's not just that, and I would argue that, and you're right, you know, any analogy is a false analogy, but it's not power that's bad in The Lord of the Rings. It's this unearned power, because I even talked about pride earlier on in the podcast, where, like, you know, I do have pride. Like, if you look at, you know, lists of best-selling authors, or if you look at, like, on Goodreads, right, I'm in the top 10 like most followed authors on Goodreads, but I'm the only one that doesn't have a movie deal, you know, and I feel pride about that. And that's not a good thing necessarily, but I cop to it. You know, it's like I got here purely on the strength of my book and people's love of my book, not because somebody dumped $80 million of marketing money onto my book.
I see. I think,
And like, how would you feel if Hasbro came to you and said, okay, Cards is hot. And I imagine that Hasbro has approached you at some point.
Well, it wouldn't be, it's not Hasbro for us. The big question is Target, right? It's like, if we sell our game in Target, we've never sold our game in any retail stores. And it's like, the pride there is like, well, we just did a good enough job. You know, no one can say that anyone gave us any like advantage in this industry, right? Like we're never sold in any stores. We never had any advertising. Like it's just word of mouth and people liked it and it was funny and they had to come and get it from us. And we've always resisted being in Target, you know, because we like how people get the game and how they find out about it. But also like I do enjoy that little bit of pride of like we're beating all these games that have every institutional advantage over us. But, you know, with Cards also and like, you know, I'm sure I have a feeling you'll get here with Kingkiller Chronicles. With Cards, I've been on both sides of the coin of being cool and being successful. And they're kind of mutually exclusive. There's a very small window where you can have both. But when you're cool, it's when your peers love what you're doing and they are excited about it because the world doesn't care and you've sort of maybe haven't been that rewarded for it and people lift you up and that feels cool. You're celebrated and appreciated. Cards is long past that point, right? Like we're a bit, you know, we've gone from being this crazy Kickstarter project that should have never succeeded into being the best-selling game on Amazon for many years now. So we're not cool anymore. No one's like, no one's like rooting for us. Like we're the man now.
And you're not the plucky underdog. Yeah.
We are not the plucky underdog, but we're successful. And that when we were cool, that's all I dreamed of was being successful. I was like, this is great, but I would love to own a house someday. Like I would love to pay my student loans off someday, or I'd like to be able to travel whenever I want, or I'd like to have an awesome office where all these cool people in Chicago can work. And now I have those things, but it's at the cost of, you know, obviously the game got big enough that it's not cool anymore. Like no one's like, oh, I hope Cards pulls through. Like, you know, we're playing, you know, it's sad, but that's how it is. It's like, now we're playing defense. Now we got this big important thing that we have to protect. And that's not as fun as, you know, being the scrappy underdog and playing offense and like throwing bombs and getting to be cool.
Yeah. And the analogy between you and me is actually, it's way better than I even thought, where, you know, and I think, in some ways, the comparison is sort of like if Hasbro did come up to you and say, we want it. We want Cards. We want to be able to produce it. We'll do our own expansions. And they're like, you can still do your expansions, right? And you can still sell those on the internet. But ours will be in Target. Ours will be in Kmart and Shopko. Ours will be in Walmart. We'll sell them in gas stations. And you'll still have yours too, you know? But we'll do this as well. And they're like, you could even come in. You can be part of the writer's room. You know, we really respect what you've done, but you know that what they do isn't going to be cards. It's not the cards that you right now have this perfect control over. And of course, and they would offer you $1 billion.
Right.
They say, let's buy it for $1 billion, and you can still make your own. You can still make the original.
If it was for all, if it was a literal $1 billion, that we'd never look back.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? I'd do it.
I'm curious. Like, and I don't know. Because everyone has a number. And I don't know. I'm so conflicted. Because I think I have this little sweet spot where I get to do what I want. I love my books. I love the people who love my books. But, like, my fear is, you know, not that the movie would be a failure, because honestly, if a movie comes out and it sucks and the studio's like, boy, okay, we were wrong about that. And I'm like, yeah, you super were. And then another one doesn't get made and everyone's like, boy, that was awful, Rothfuss. I'm like, yeah, it was. And then eventually all the rights revert to me and, you know, my sales get a bump, but eventually it all comes, all the rights come home to me, like my abandoned children. And then I can move on. That's not my fear. I have two fears. One is that probably my biggest one is that they turn it into something saleable and dumb. Something that looks kind of like what I made, but with all of the subversion pulled out of it and all of the love and kindness pulled out of it and all of the cleverness pulled out of it. But it's still got, you know, kind of some magic, and it's kind of got like an orphan boy, and it's kind of got like a dragon. And like, that's my fear, that they would... there's two fears. One is that they would do that, make a decent movie that wears my IP like a skin suit. And the other legitimate fear that keeps me awake at night is that it would be half a dog. So let's say you have a delicious sandwich, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I would like to make a movie out of your delicious sandwich. The analogy has some problems, right? But if I take your delicious sandwich and I cut it in half, it's still, that half a sandwich is still delicious, because half a sandwich can still be good.
Mm-hmm.
And if my movie, if the movie that was made was half a sandwich, I would probably feel okay with that, because it would still be the same thing, just maybe not as much as you had hoped for. But let's say you have a dog and you get half a dog. Half a dog is not, no one enjoys half a dog. Half a dog is not a functioning organism.
No one enjoys half a dog.
No one enjoys half a dog. And I worry that, I mean, Hollywood in general, and I really don't mean to speak badly of Lionsgate, because they've proven their ability to adapt these books. You know, and the team that I work with and the consideration they've showed me and the kindness and the willingness to listen to me. I respect these people, and I genuinely believe that they respect me and the book and they want to do right by it. But Hollywood, you know, has a tendency to occasionally make half a dog. Because they don't understand really what the beating heart of a story is.
To be fair, though, if they do make 10 half dogs, that's 5 dogs.
No, no, no. 10 half dogs is not 5 dogs. 10 half dogs is 10 half dogs. Imagine
by weight.
By weight, you are correct.
Yeah.
By strict algebra, you are correct. But imagine showing up at somebody's house. Which is worse, seeing one half dog or 10 half dogs?
Yeah.
There you go. Once you visualize it, you realize that I have to be right. Oh, by the way, I'm drinking Amarula. It's a cream liqueur. That's how you can tell I'm hardcore, right?
Yeah.
But it's made out of that fruit.
It sounds fancy.
It looks fancy. It's made out of that fruit that it grows on a tree in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And it ferments naturally, and the elephants drink it and get all shitty drunk. Have you ever seen those videos?
The fruit that grows on the tree in Africa? What kind of a description is that?
Oh, you don't know about this?
What the hell are you talking about? Ah, the African apple.
Did you just look it up?
No, I don't know. What the hell are you talking about?
No, but it is, and you'll have to put a link to this down in the liner notes as well.
Uh-huh. Describing a corn as the vegetable that grows on the ground in America. Pat, how far can a dog run into the woods?
I don't know.
Halfway. The rest of the time he's running out. This episode's a real half dog.
This might be a half dog of an episode.
This is a real half dog. We're a little too drunk. There was a lot of boy penis this week. I don't know. All right, I'm gonna go rotate my brisket.
That's right. You have to tell people why you're in the office at this ungodly hour. I text Max, and I'm like, "Oh, I'm getting in kind of late. My flight was delayed. Can we still record tonight?" And Max says,
"Oh, well, I'm staying. I got to stay here until like 2 a.m. to flip my brisket."
Yep, which remains my favorite text I have ever received to date. Yeah.